I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will.
Hello and welcome to Unfrozen, episode 127, The Other Housing Crisis. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Our guest today is Todd Swanstrom. He is the author, the main editor of the book, The Other Housing Crisis, and he is also a professor at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, where he is the Des Lee Professor of Community Collaboration and Public Policy Administration. Todd, welcome.
Thank you. One of the longest titles in the Western Hemisphere.
I think all the academic titles are vying for that one. But it's great to have you. This is, of course, something, housing is and affordability is a huge topic on the tongues of just about everyone in the built environment community. And you're coming in with an interesting angle here, which is that there is an untalked about housing crisis that or one aspect to solving the overall housing crisis that isn't being discussed, which is the renovation of existing homes. That's an interesting tack. Can you tell us what gave the rise to the book and how you happened upon this thesis?
Well, you know, there's a huge conversation in the United States about housing affordability, which, of course, is a very significant issue. People pay too much for housing, especially young people who can't afford to buy their first home. The average age of first-time home buyers has gone way up. About half of renters are paying more than 50% of their income on rent. So you have a huge affordability crisis. But this whole national conversation about housing affordability totally ignores the issue of housing quality. And housing quality and housing affordability are not two separate issues. They are two sides of the same coin. Most people acquire their affordable housing, not through government subsidies, but through purchasing or renting housing that is in a sufficiently disinvested neighborhood or sufficiently deteriorated that it becomes quote unquote affordable. So there's really a missing piece in all of this, because what's happening is a lot of people are forced to trade off quality for affordability. So when we look at the statistics, the famous statistic, of course, of you shouldn't spend more than 30% of your income on rent, turns out there are many people who may spend less than 30% of income on rent, but they're living in homes that are making them sick, and they're unsafe and unhealthy. I would hardly call that affordable housing. In the book that we're throwing away about 400,000 units of housing a year that become deteriorated, abandoned, and eventually demolished. That makes no sense if the whole issue is this issue of supply and affordability, right? Now, we're not saying that, you know, repairing homes is going to solve the housing affordability crisis, but we're saying we got to get away from this idea that either we increase the supply or we spend money on preserving existing housing. We clearly need to do both. And it's a much more serious issue than people perceive. It's something that's been very low on the radar. And I'm old enough to know that back in the 70s and 80s, housing repair and housing deterioration was a much bigger issue and got much more attention from the federal government. So as the worst problem has gotten worse, the age of housing has gone up, the amount of federal funding for home repairs has gone down. So it's a significant problem. It doesn't get the attention it deserves. There's very, very poor data on the issue. We have good data on affordability, right? Because that 30% standard, which you'll find that in the newspapers, right? You'll find that on the news, right? But point to me where the data is on housing quality, right? There is no national good quality data on housing, housing quality.
You mentioned that there is actually an existing there is kind of an existing data collection enterprise, which is the American Housing Survey, and that is actually a national data source on housing quality, but it has some problems with it. What are some of the issues with it? Yes.
Well, don't get me going, Dan. This could be, you're talking to a professor here. This could take about an hour, but no, it's a serious issue. The American Housing Survey is the only national survey which surveys housing units, not people, right? The census, you know, talks to people, the business census. This is a census of units. It has a pretty large sample. But, you know, it was devised going back many years All the way back, you know, there was a census of housing back in the 40s, and in the 70s, they converted it to the American Housing Survey. It does have a way of measuring what they call inadequate or severely inadequate housing, but that measurement is very flawed. Okay, one thing is, for example, to give you one major factor here, it requires, as it really should, just as housing codes do, right, that a unit have a functioning heating system. It does not require a functioning cooling system. So that there is no, in this measurement of adequate or inadequate housing, there is no measurement of the ability to maintain a safe temperature during heat waves. And of course, that's become a significant issue in recent years with the increasing severity of urban heat waves, urban heat island effects, all of that. So they totally ignore that. They totally ignore questions of functioning of major units in rental multifamily units. They ignore safety issues. They ignore issues that people can't readily see, right? There might be mold behind a wall. Now, there was a great study out of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve, which took the answers to the AHS, the American Housing Survey, and converted them to what they call repair scenarios, and then costed out those repair scenarios. So for the first time, about 5 years ago, we got an actual dollar estimate of how much it would require to bring American homes up to code, up to standard, right? And I applaud the researchers, and one of the researchers at the Philadelphia Fed is in our book, has a great article in our book, and she would acknowledge right away that the data upon which they're making this estimate is flawed. They came up with an estimate, by the way, of $197 billion in repairs and arrears, which is a big number, but it's not nearly as big as it would be if we had a more comprehensive and fulsome way of measuring housing deterioration. As an example, what we did in St. Louis, we took that methodology of asking people about their experience of their home and then converted that into housing repair scenarios. We have 43 repair scenarios we identified in our questionnaire, right? And so, for example, we went in and we asked older homeowners in St. Louis. We got a grant and we sent out 2,500, you know, questionnaires to older homeowners in St. Louis. And I have to tell this one anecdote because it really gives you an idea of why I got so motivated on this issue. My name was on the front page of the questionnaire, and it said, if you have any questions, contact Professor Todd Swanson, and gave my phone number. So I turned to the survey researcher and I said, Cynthia, am I going to get a bunch of phone calls? And she said, don't worry, Todd, you'll get probably five. Well, I got over 200 phone calls. They were just tear your heart out. I mean, people, we were clear that we didn't have any money, but people were desperate for money to fix up their home. A lot of them were African-American widows living in bigger, older St. Louis homes. The average age of the homes, by the way, in our sample was 97 years in St. Louis. So St. Louis is a historic, older, you know, beautiful brick frame housing stock, by the way, which I'm sure the two of you would really appreciate. But, you know, and in one case, the one that sticks in my mind is the woman who said, well, Professor, I filled out your questionnaire, but I couldn't get to the mailbox because my stairs have collapsed. But the boy next door came over and I handed him through the window and he took it to the mailbox. And by the way, do you have any money for repair my stairs? And all I could do with all these phone calls was refer people to programs with 3 to 5 year waiting lists. And even they are suppressing applications, right? Because they have too many applicants for the existing funding. So we measured, getting back to the story, we measured housing deterioration in St. Louis using this methodology, which is not perfect. You know, the perfect methodology, the better methodology, would be to send inspectors into every home and have them write up all the code violations and what it would do. But you can imagine that would be insanely expensive to do a representative sample of homes in St. Louis. So we came up, according to our study, and this was about 4 or 5 years ago, the average older homeowner in St. Louis had over $13,000 in repairs in arrears. When I first saw that number, I wasn't too shocked. Well, $13,000, you know. By the way, it would be much higher now because we know there's been inflation in the construction industry and shortage of labor. But if you think about it, $13,000, that's on average. That could be a major hole in the roof. That could be a collapsed porch. That could be, you know, a furnace that doesn't work properly, etc. And so we recently completed a study, and then I won't go on too much more about the data and the research, but we just completed a study of St. Louis County. So we did the same thing. We mailed out 6,000 surveys to all single family homes, a representative sample of all single family homes in St. Louis County. St. Louis County, by the way, is the area around the city of St. Louis. So it's the suburban part. It's kind of confusing that St. Louis City is itself a county, but we won't go down that road. But anyway, so we mailed out 6,000 surveys, and the figure we came up was the average single family home in suburban St. Louis County had over 9,100 in need of repairs, and it would cost $2.8 billion to repair the homes in St. Louis County. And finally, and I'll stop my data talk here, unless you want to go further down this, tried to estimate, well, you know, how many people lack the resources to do the repairs on their own. Either they have a home that has equity in it they could draw upon to do the repairs, or they have the income. And so using the 200% of poverty cutoff, in other words, people who are pretty low income, right, who almost certainly would need help to find $13,000 or $9,000 to fix up their home, we calculated that the demand for subsidized repairs in St. Louis County is about $770 million. At best, St. Louis County spends $5 to $7 million a year on subsidized home repairs. So we're doing less than 1% of the need in St. Louis County. We've also done numbers for the national figure, but no matter how you cut it, there's a huge problem. It's getting worse all the time, and we're falling further behind, right? In other words, housing is actually deteriorating faster than we're fixing it up.
All right. So I want to thank you, Todd, for that. That was an incredibly granular walkthrough. So my first question, shifting to policy, the first question I ask is, how does this missing piece of the conversation scramble the narratives around housing? Because, like, for example, I would say, like, you could build a YIMBY straw man, for example, who would say, well, this is a feature, not a bug, right? If we let the market build luxury units, then over time it will trickle down into affordable housing. But you're arguing that by the time it trickles down, it's not fit for purpose. So that stands out. And then there's the whole discussion around it as well, too, about economic geography, right? I mean, no, not to throw shade on St. Louis, but like you look at Detroit 15 years ago, you would say, of course, there are entire neighborhoods going back to the grassland because there's no economic opportunity. Gary, Indiana, these icons of American disinvestment. So what do you do in cases like that? Is there triage that basically involved that some places we should invest in repair or others too far gone? How do you sort of do that analysis?
And then justice? Great questions, Greg. You hit the nail on the head. There is this something called housing filtering theory you may have heard of, which is this idea that and by the way, the de facto, not the de jure, but the de facto affordable housing strategy in the United States is not to build low-income housing, subsidized low-income housing for low-income folks directly, but rather to increase the supply of housing, let the older housing filter down to low-income folks, and that's where they get their affordable housing. That's our strategy, in effect, right? So housing filtering theory would say, hey, this is all good, Professor Swanstrom. We're building new housing all the time. The older housing filters down kind of from the middle class to the lower middle class to the working class to the poor, right? And that increased supply of housing, that surplus supply of housing, drives down the cost for low-income folks who now can afford to buy a bigger house, right? That's left behind by the people who moved further out to the suburbs in the new suburban utopia. And now there are huge problems with housing filtering. It assumes that it has this sort of modernization narrative, right? That we are modernizing as a society and housing will filter down, and when it gets to the end of the filtering chain, it will be obsolescent, it will be old-fashioned, behind the times, we'll tear it down and we'll build anew. Well, of course, we know that's not what happens in places like St. Louis and Youngstown and Cleveland and Milwaukee and other places. The neighborhoods get left behind, people get stuck there, and it's not redeveloped, right? There's not a modern replacement of the housing that's at the end of the filtering chain. The other thing is housing filtering is not a smooth, nice, general approach that, you know, provides lower income folks with good housing. It's rapid and chaotic and destructive and leaves people in neighborhoods, as you pointed out, Greg, with very little market demand, low rates of density, high crime, and of course all the problems associated with a declining tax base, poor services, poor schools, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, you're really hitting the nail on the head, Greg, in terms of our argument, because I think the most immediate response is, Well, Professor Schmonster, if we turned around and spent all this money fixing up these homes, clearly there's not a demand for many of these homes. That's why people have left these neighborhoods behind, because they prefer to live in nice suburban, you know, sylvan settings with nice greenery and trees and big lots and everything. And of course, there is some truth to that, by the way. So there are neighborhoods in these, especially these older legacy cities, which there's very little market, relatively little market demand. But the problem is, as we all know, that with the whole gentrification narrative, which is another topic I could get going on, but basically, we know that many older neighborhoods have come back. People want to live in mixed-use older neighborhoods. So we're throwing away housing that actually a lot of people would like if it had the bones, if it had the mixed uses, if it was pedestrian-friendly, and, you know, and so, and to put another element on my answer or my riposte to your question, Greg, would be that you know, it's much less expensive to preserve and repair older housing than it is to build from scratch. So, you know, the phrase is, you know, the greenest home is the home that's already been built. So, you know, if you have to build a new house and then you demolish an older house at the end of the filtering chain, that's hugely expensive in turn, because you have this embodied energy in the old house, right? I mean, all the money, all the energy that it took to transport the materials and build the materials and put it together. And to say nothing of the sidewalks and the sewer lines and the water lines and the electrical lines and everything else. So it's a very expensive proposition, the way we've approached increasing the supply and affordability issues. While I would say of those 400,000 units, Greg, if I have to be honest, I'd say, could we save all 400,000? No, but we could save many of them. And it would be much less expensive, much more effective, and it would contribute. And then the second part of the equation is, of course, if we began repairing homes, people would be much healthier and much safer. So there's studies that show that for every dollar invested in home repair, we get, according to one study that I thought was quite robust and quite well done, that you get $2.85 in social return for every dollar invested in home repair. Most of that is in health savings, right? People who then, because they don't end up in a nursing home, they don't end up in the emergency room, they don't have asthma attacks, all these sorts of things. So there's a tremendous savings. And in the community development work I do, for years we've been trying to get the hospital systems to say, you know, why don't you invest in repairing housing, because that'll prevent the kid from returning to the emergency room for another asthma attack. And we have had some success, but it's very difficult to, you know, to completely securely make that connection between repair investment and savings in medical costs, right? And a friend of mine calls it the wrong pocket syndrome, right? We do work to repair houses and somebody else saves the money, right? And they don't know that we did the work and we saved the money. So, you know, the point about, Greg, the point you were raising about you know, market demand is a really important issue, because it's not just houses that deteriorate, it's neighborhoods that deteriorate, right? And we need to preserve neighborhoods. And then one final point is that if we're talking about affordable housing, we're talking about young people can't afford to get a house, older housing is great starter homes, great people to get people in the market. There's not the NIMBY problem, right? Already it's housing, people live in it. So if we preserve it, there's not going to be a NIMBYism to keep it out. And yet we turn ourselves into a pretzel to build new housing. And finally, and this is something we can talk about if you want to down the way, is that our main housing supply policy in the contemporary United States is the tax credit. And the tax credit industry is remarkably ineffective, but it's remarkably politically powerful. So that has really drowned out any effort to get housing preservation and repair on the public policy agenda, because the tax credit industry is a bipartisan, powerful lobby. I call it the tax credit industrial complex. So it's very hard to even be heard with this issue of home repair, which I think to most people ears when I say, well, we need to invest more in home repair. Well, that's kind of quaint, Professor Schwanstrom, you know, that's a nice charitable thing. Maybe we should do that for some old widows or whatever. But in fact, I think it's an investment. It should be an investment in the infrastructure of society. Just like we're, you know, invest in infrastructure, we invest in roads and highways and water systems, we should invest in our housing.
All right. Well, that was fantastic. A couple things to build on there in terms of questions. One, when you mentioned like older housing is starter housing, I think my favorite factoid there is Pope Leo's home in suburban Chicago. Dan and I are both from Chicago suburbs. That kind of tiny, like, just, I mean, was that even 1,000 square feet? Like, I just imagine all of that housing in the quiet inner suburbs of Chicago and other legacy cities that could be repaired. But what I want to ask you about is, of course, the policy response to this then, too, because we're in an interesting moment right now. In New York, you have Mayor Mamdani, who's publicly shaming, you know, slumlords again. The Road to Housing Act, our first significant, truly federal housing bill passed in at least a generation, maybe two. And then, as Dan and I were discussing on either the previous or upcoming episode of Unfrozen, because we're in a sort of a quantum state at the moment, the Mortgage Bankers Association just put out a report where they looked at current delivery trends in new housing against historical household formation and its decline, plus coupled with the Trump administration's immigration policies, and argued that by the 2040s, we could have an oversupply of housing, that because we're simply demographically shrinking. And so that sort of calls for the notion of, like, maybe we should stop building and start repairing. So I'm curious, like, you know, what your thoughts of the recent developments are in terms of the policy that was passed and what's missing and what's needed.
Well, I think you're making an excellent point about the demographics, because we're so used as a country to be constantly growing, constantly expanding, population constantly expanding. And that's not going to be the case, it looks like, in the near future. We're approaching a demographic winter, right, where there's going to be more deaths than births. And especially, of course, what was helping us out was the flow of immigration, which was supplying, and which is really crucial in the home repair industry, by the way, and construction industry more broadly. So there is, I think, a real problem with the supply side approach. This idea that if we could just deregulate the market, this is the abundance conversation, right? And I'm all in favor of it. You know, I have a book called Place Matters, where we talk about, the fourth edition is coming up, where we talk about, you know, we want to do away with this exclusionary zoning that's preventing us from building denser, more affordable housing. Is clearly part of the problem. However, it may be necessary, but it's certainly not sufficient for the addressing the issue of housing affordability. For one thing, this idea that the new housing market is concentrated on the luxury end. The home builders have tended, over the years, they've moved in the direction of building bigger and bigger homes. I think the average size of the new home went up to something like 2,700 square feet a few years ago. It came down a little bit, but it's still quite high, especially by international standards. That's huge. And of course, back in the 40s and 50s, you know, the average home was, new home was 1,200, 1,400, 1,500 square feet, maybe. We're building, we have a lot of housing, but is it where the housing needs to be? And is for the people who really need it? And, you know, that filtering chain, once again, this idea that if you build luxury housing on the end of the filter, will it benefit? Because the real issue is lower income families. Lower income families with children just simply can't afford to rent, and in some communities to own, right? So it's a real problem. And this idea that the conversation about housing affordability has been dominated by this idea of increased supply. And there's been some research by friends of mine and others that suggests that just increasing the supply is not necessarily going to improve affordability, especially for those near the bottom, right? So we need to think about how do we, you know, I think this idea that if we just free up the market will solve our problems. There is no country in the world that's where the market supplies affordable housing for all families, right? There's lots of subsidies going on in Europe. They have a lot of social housing, a lot of subsidies, and a lot of government support for affordable housing and public housing and other sectors. So the idea that if we free up the market, we'll somehow magically solve the problem of affordability is simply wrong. And I think that at home repair, now in the recent legislation, the road legislation, which, you know, I'm totally in favor of. You'll notice, by the way, it has very little money appropriated for it. So that's one reason it was able to get bipartisan support, I think. And I think it's doing the right thing, by the way. I think manufactured housing, this idea of the chassis, you know, you probably heard about. But, you know, I think it's all moving in the right direction. So once again, I think it's necessary but not sufficient. But it has a pilot program. on whole home repair, which is modeled on the home repair program in Pennsylvania. So it has an act in it, which we were very happy about. There's a group of about a dozen organizations in D.C. that are trying to get this issue on the agenda. And you know, I guess it's kind of like getting the camel's nose under the tent, right? It's only a $30 million program, which is a drop in the bucket. However, if we could show that it works and perhaps you know, have an evaluation of this program showing the social return to repairing homes and doing what's called the whole home approach. So one of the conversations in the public policy literature, Dan and Greg, is this question of whole home repairs, as opposed to the system we have now, which is highly fragmented and highly siloed. I was a co-author on a report put up by the Joint Center at Harvard on housing deterioration and home repair, and we found there were 15 federal programs that funded home repair. Now, many of them are quite small, don't get me wrong, but what that means is home repair is fragmented and siloed into all these separate programs. As my friend Alan Malik puts it, home repair is always a bridesmaid, never a bride, right? We're always doing home repair for someone else. Do home repair to help with weatherization. Do home repair for veterans. Do home repair for the handicapped. Do home repair for the elderly. But how about doing home repair for home repair, right, to make the home work for whoever lives in it, right, to address all the issues. So on the ground in the present home repair ecosystem, you have great groups here in St. Louis working on home repair, right? And they're constrained by their funding source. They're all doing one part of the need, right? Dealing with veterans, dealing with the elderly, dealing with you know, certain neighborhoods. And as a result, it's not a whole home approach, right? Often they're basically doing triage. They might go in and say to Mrs. Smith, well, we can fix your toilet, but we can't fix your roof. So we'll fix your toilet because it's leaking all over your, you know, and then she comes back 3 months later and says, you've got to do something about my roof, right? So, and that weakens, I think, now, obviously, if you do whole home repair, you do fewer homes, right? But I think we have a home repair network we've created here in St. Louis to try to build up this issue and reform the sector. And we think that we can make a much better public case for home repair if we do it right, right? If we do it holistically, if we do it to make the home work for people. And it's, you know, not just home repair. It could be home adaptation. It could be home remodeling, right? I mean, you were talking about all the small homes, you know, built in the 40s and 50s. I think it was Greg. And, you know, if you look at Levittown, they've adapted those Levittown homes and they built on. They started out, I think they were as little as 1,100 square feet, weren't they the original Levittown homes? And now they're 2,000, 2,500, you know, so you can adapt these homes and invest in them and build upon that structure. So I think there's a tremendous potential here. And, you know, at least we got something in the bill, right? We're not thrilled about it, but we're thinking that maybe we can build on this and bring attention to this issue. But the whole conversation has been hijacked by the kind of supply side, free up the market approach. And I'm not against it, but it's not the solution.
All right. So following up on that then, I've just co-written a paper that, again, we're either discussing in the next episode or just finished discussing. So I'm either teasing it or not boring our listeners with it. But it looks at sort of what the supply chain can do how do we fix the entire supply chain of delivering any building in America to fix this crisis? And one of the scenarios we look at is a sort of imagining a world of radical adaptive reuse and those sorts of things. So from a manufacturing / design / repair, part of that whole home repair, what have you seen in terms of solutions and interventions to basically think about, like, how do we institute or should reform housing to make it more repairable versus the sort of siloed approaches to various individual systems and things? Like, you mentioned, like, the road to housing sort of, like, frees up manufactured housing a little bit beyond trailer homes as we think of them and that stigma, moving more towards the Swedish-Japanese model. Are there other approaches that we should be thinking about that would, like, kits, I guess, to repair these homes from scratch or reinvent them from there? Yeah, what can we do from a design intervention?
Well, it's a good question. Now, home repair, if there ever is a function in society, in the division of labor in society that is not amenable to AI and robotics, it's probably home repair, right? I mean, you have to go into someone's home. It's all vernacular. It's not. That's why people, you know, what happens is people go into home repair. They start a company. They do well in home repair, but they always move to new construction because it's easier, right? You have a greenfield site. You can build. Everything's a right angle, you know, right? You know. So anyway, home repair. Now, home repair is subject to certain kinds of automation and certain kinds of reform. To build a scale, for example, their program in Detroit where they're doing like 1,000 roofs at once, right? That's a big help because if you can get a contractor to say, I'm gonna give you, you know, 200 roofs over the next year and a half. Hey, they can ramp up, they can do one after the other, right? They can buy in bulk, and so there are certain economies of scale that you can achieve by scaling up maybe certain basic repairs. I think that. Another thing that really needs to be part of the conversation, it gets back to our earlier discussion, is to have a spatial approach to home repair, which is to say, one of the things that would make sense is to invest in home repairs that can stabilize a what we call middle neighborhood that might be vulnerable to decline and disinvestment and could lead to vacancy and abandonment. So you go into home neighborhoods that are on the edge, right? They're neither really strong nor really weak. They have assets. In some ways, they have underutilized assets, underleveraged assets, right? They might have, you know, walkable business districts. They might have parks. They might have schools. But they could go downhill, right, if they deteriorate. So if you invest home repair dollars there, especially in external visible repairs, right, because so much of neighborhood dynamics has to do with the appearance and the psychology. Is this neighborhood going downhill? And the sort of broken windows theory, right? If you have a one broken window, okay, you know, it turns out, you know, just a few houses on a block that have a broken window or a cracked porch can really stigmatize that block and lead to disinvestment. But it can go the other direction, right? If you can buttress the appearance and buttress the homes. And so one of the ways to make it more efficient and effective is geographical targeting. And, you know, from this point of view, we don't have to wait. In my opinion, we don't need to wait for the federal government to act here. The city of Philadelphia has issued general obligation bonds, and they've used funds, hundreds of millions of dollars, from general obligation bonds to repair homes. I think it's a fiscal winner for the city of Philadelphia, right? Because you're buttressing neighborhoods that otherwise might experience disinvestment and decline. Now, can I prove it? No, at this point. They've done a lot. They're kind of the leading edge of good home repair programs in the country, Philadelphia. Of course, one of the oldest cities in the country, right? So you can imagine. And they have this row house repair program that you can imagine, you know, can be quite effective, you know, because it's concentrated and you can do it. You can get the scale of it moving well. So I think that this idea that, you know, that it's, you know, I think home repair is often viewed, investing is often viewed as either maybe historical preservation for elites who want to, you know, repair, you know, kind of at a very, high and expensive level, a historic property that they will curate to their elite sensibilities. Or on the other hand, it's charity, right? It's kind of for somebody who, there's kind of a sweet spot in the middle, right? Where home repair investments, reinvestment and repair is a wise investment in the infrastructure of your city, right? And makes sense in terms of looking at it as an investment that's going to pay off, right? So from that point of view, and there are cities around the country that are doing this, right? That are beginning to issue bonds and using that money to repair the housing stock to solidify neighborhoods that otherwise might experience a contagious abandonment and demolition.
I mean, it's wild to think about. One of the arguments that I think is made in the book is that there is really no home repair lobby in the same way that there is a construction lobby that supports, you know, contractors, albeit they tend to be on the higher, larger volume scale. And as Greg and I have pointed out millions of times on various episodes, you know, the institutionalization of housing production is only increasing. So, you know, looking in that direction toward large institutions and being interested in financing this type of thing en masse doesn't look super promising. But at the same time, you see such an interest in popular culture in home renovation through all these shows like HGTV And as you mentioned, a lot of those things are high end, like, oh, we turn this into this super gentrified, you know, modern farmhouse kitchen, and we put it into this bungalow, and now it's great, and we can flip it. I mean, it seems like, you know, that somewhere between that we've got to be able to meet, right, between the idea that this is a bespoke thing for urban elites to do versus it's a charity case versus, you know, institutionalized housing. Yes, exactly. You know, of course, this was so popular that it was satirized viciously in The Curse, which is a great TV series about some overambitious flippers who go to Hispaniola, New Mexico, and turn out all these ridiculous houses that have nothing to do with the community. I would just think that somewhere between the popular culture and the institutional culture, there's a way to build this coalition, even if it's not as simple as looking to the National Association of Home Builders, for example.
Well, really interesting points, Dan. I think what's happened is, once again, back in the 70s, being the old man that I am, I remember when, you know, home repair was part of a movement that we're going to preserve the cities. We're not going to let the bulldozer come and tear down our neighborhoods, right? It was kind of a movement. It really had some elan. It had, you know, the urban pioneers would go in there. What seems to me has happened is that home repair has become an item of consumption. It's been co-opted by, you know, so flippers, the whole point about flippers, right, is to make money. You're going to make a killing. You buy some old house, you fix it up, you know, you turn it over, you sell it, you make lots of money. And, you know, my wife and daughters are often watching these shows, you know, about what some of these homes, one of them takes place in the South. I'm trying to remember the name. But anyway, they love watching. And it's fun to watch, you know, the old home be fixed up and people, you know, just, you know, really. And there is maybe some progressive impulse there. But a lot of the home remodeling repair industry has been, I think, been co-opted as a commodity good, as a item of consumption, right? Not something that is valuable in and of itself. The other thing that's going on here, I firmly believe, is that the gentrification conversation has cast a shadow over repair and renovation, right? That when people go into an old neighborhood and repair and rent, oh, I know what you're up to, Professor Swanson. You're a gentrifier, right? You're gonna push out the low income folks who lived in that neighborhood. So that conversation didn't exist in 1970, right? People weren't shamed because they moved into an older urban neighborhood and started fixing up the homes. Now, it's a legitimate issue, right? If people are coming into a neighborhood, flipping the houses and pushing out longtime residents of the neighborhood. So it's a legitimate issue. But I think the whole gentrification narrative has made almost anyone who goes into an old neighborhood as part of the problem, not part of the solution, right? And we need to have a way, and this is a whole other conversation on another day, but, you know, we need to have the gentrification conversation. We need to recognize people's fears about displacement and their legitimate fears about rising rents and rising land values and unaffordability and displacement. But there's ways, especially in a city like St. Louis, to fix up older housing and enable the people who have lived there for years remain there and benefit from a more prosperous neighborhood, right? To benefit from a neighborhood that's more viable, has better schools, has more retail opportunities, et cetera. So, but, you know, the other thing that's going on here, I think there's a whole cultural conversation, which I think is alive. And I think I'm looking forward to writing more about this in the future. Which is, you know, this whole idea. My daughter, for example, has a sustainable fashion company that does clothing that's a little more expensive, made from natural fabrics, intended to last longer, intended to be repaired, right? And not to be thrown away after you wear it 10 times. It's clothing that becomes more precious, perhaps, not so much I'm just going to go out tomorrow and buy a cheap, you know, cheap dress, and then 6 months from now I'll get another dress, right? And so I think there's a conversation, you know, in the country that's going on about there's the right to repair movement, if you've heard about that, which is this idea that, you know, manufacturers are building things in such a way that you can't repair them. I mean, you literally can't repair them. You have to just turn them in. The farmers are all upset because their combines, they can't repair their combine. It has to go back to the manufacturer, and they actually miss the harvest. So they're really up in arms, and that's where a lot of the juice for that right to repair movement is coming from. But I think it's a broader movement. I think there is a counterculture. I sense a counterculture. I don't know what you two think. I sense a counterculture about mending, repairing, valuing, you know, investing, you know, all these kinds of senses in which, whether it's in homes or in home devices, or in manufacturing, that there's at least a subculture that says we should make more of an effort to maintain and repair things. The fellow who wrote Stuart Brand, who wrote the Whole Earth Catalog, wrote a book called Maintenance. I think it's called The Maintenance of Everything. I have it here somewhere. And it's really kind of cool and interesting. But the point is, he makes the point, and I think he gives the quote, he may not, Kurt Vonnegut says, you know, one of the flaws in human nature is everybody wants to build new things, but no one wants to maintain them, you know? And I think there's a truth to it. But there is a counter movement that Brand represents, right, to repair and mend and value what we have and not to throw it away. So we're throwing away housing the way we throw away Kleenex, you know, at the end of the cycle. And it's unhealthy, in my opinion. So it's not just a kind of problem of affordability and poverty, right? It's also a problem of the culture, right, which has created a throwaway society and you know, has not valued. And you know, here in St. Louis, we have these older neighborhoods with this wonderful brick frame housing stock that has great bones. They have a lot of room for ground level retail, but they've been totally disinvested. And so we're sprawling out. We have a frictionless plane, you know, here in St. Louis. No oceans or deserts to stop us from sprawling. So we're leaving behind these what I think are very attractive neighborhoods. And if you look at if you look underneath the data, you see a lot of people would like to live in a, you know, in a solid, you know, mixed use neighborhood with historic homes that meet their needs, maybe not quite as big as the suburban, you know, cheaply built brick, you know, stick built house. So I think there's a cultural issue as well.
No, absolutely. Yeah. You would need a transformation of values, I think, to really change this. But two questions that sort of that push back on you a bit. On the gentrification aspect, I'm curious if you've seen, because St. Louis, of course, is part of the legacy city discourse, but in some of the more coastal megacity high cost ones, like New York, for example, there's definitely the case that, you know, that middle class communities of color in Brooklyn have pushed back against like better bus service, for example, because they see improvements of access to their neighborhood as destroying the moat that's kept gentrifiers out. So you have this sad, perverse spectacle of them arguing for worse services as a way to protect them. And I'm curious if you've seen that in a housing context. And then the other one I'm curious about is like your thoughts on someone like a Harvard's Raj Chetty, for example, who takes the argument, and I think Ed Glazer at Harvard as well has taken this too, of we should move the people to the opportunity, not have them stay in place and repair their crumbling homes in places of less economic opportunity. Chetty, of course, you know, just wrote a whole big analysis of like Hope Six, for example, arguing that it was incredibly powerful for the children of the former residents of public housing who moved into those communities. Like, should we be moving the people, or should we be saving the housing as the debate that goes back and forth? I think I'm inclined to go with you, but that's part of sort of the economic geography argument, I think.
Well, a couple good questions. Don't let me lose the Chetty question here when I answer your first question. You got to remember your first question, you know, which is, and I think, frankly, so you might say, well, Professor Swanstrom, your concern about a legacy city may be valid, but it's very different in Washington, D.C., Boston, and New York, right, where you have hot market cities with gentrification pushing people out. Well, the research does not support the idea that neighborhoods undergoing gentrification are the major cause of involuntary displacement of people. Now, neighborhoods, a lot of it may be replacement, not displacement, which is to say, when housing units turn over and the natural order of things with people who are moving in are young professionals without children, you know, a different demographic. Here in St. Louis, we have a big issue around the country, by the way, in middle neighborhoods is black flight. Black people are moving out of neighborhoods, not because they're being gentrified, because they're seeking a better place and they can move to a suburb with better schools. And they're, you know, that's going on. But often that is misattributed to gentrification. Right. There's a lot of major studies. It's a subject of a great deal of controversy, and I think I get myself in trouble in scholarly circles because I don't take the politically correct position that gentrification is in all instances bad, and you know it's but rather, you know, once again, as I said before, dealt with in an we have, you know, the Eskimos supposedly have 70 names for snow, but we only have one name for economically ascending neighborhoods: gentrification, right? And it's a very abstract kind of argument, very simplistic in my view. It's much more complex. Cities have always had rising markets and falling markets. They've always had these dynamics. The neighborhood cannot stay the same forever. That's not a bad thing. We need fresh energy. We need fresh people. And like I say, there's a great deal of empirical research that tries to ask, you know, and even in strong market cities like New York, no, it turns out that gentrified neighborhoods do not have any more displacement than non-gentrified neighborhoods, right? Now, of course, the problem with that is defining gentrification, it turns out, is very complicated. People have different definitions of what is gentrification. So, but as an example, Matthew Desmond and colleagues at the Eviction Lab have a study, a major study, in which they use eviction rates as a kind of indicator of involuntary displacement. And they found no relationship between gentrification and eviction. So this whole narrative, I think, has been constructed. There's a kind of, I think it misattributes. Now, do we have a problem with housing affordability? Damn right we do. People pay too much for housing. They're being squeezed. They don't have enough for other necessities like food and transportation and education and other things. So there is a problem. A lot of it is low wages, right? And the problem is, you know, people aren't paid enough to afford decent housing. So the whole gentrification narrative is also, in my opinion, a little bit like the supply side narrative with affordability, has hijacked the conversation in a direction which is, I think, not productive. Now, people have genuine fears about displacement. Here in St. Louis, for example, we have a whole history of urban renewal and highway building that displaced tens of thousands of African, largely African-American families from communities. So I understand where their fears come from, right? I go out in the community and work in the community. And I'm telling you this, Professor Swanstrom has learned, don't go out there and tell people their gentrification fears are misplaced. The data does not show that their neighborhood is actually gentrifying. That is the wrong thing to do. Acknowledge their fears and then pivot as quickly as possible to what might be called inclusive development. That is development that can accommodate the people who live there now. And that has largely to do with property ownership, by the way. If you own a home, you're going to benefit from rising values. And people will talk about, well, then their taxes are going to go up. But property taxes are generally on the order of 1 to 2%. If I owned a $100,000 home and it went up $10,000, then I wouldn't mind losing $100 to get my $9,900, right? Or whatever. I think, I don't know if I'm doing the numbers quite right. $900 to get $9,900, right? But so anyway, the point is that these conversations have been hijacked and I think have steered us away from more intelligent, real, you know, solutions to these problems. Now, with regard to the Chetty issue of moving to opportunity, absolutely. We should help low-income folks move to opportunity. We should also, what we argue in the Place Matters book, and some way down the line, you should have one of my co-authors of that book when it comes out, probably about a year from now, on your show. It'd be fun. But we definitely should help people to move to opportunity. And the data on that, there were some reports at one point that it hadn't particularly improved people's lives as much as people thought. But later on, when you did the controls and you controlled for the time of exposure and the exposure to a low poverty area, right, you find it has major significant positive impacts on people's lives, right? So place matters, right? Where you live matters in your quality of your life, your ability to succeed. But on the other hand, we should also at the same time develop the communities where people presently live. We should do place-based and people-based programs, help people to move and help people to develop. In fact, only because people have the freedom to move do they really end up valuing their community. If they're stuck in a community, that means they're going to have less commitment to that community because they know they're in a community that's experiencing failure, right? So, I've read his stuff extensively. It's great stuff. And for those of us in the field, by the way, we're a little bit chagrined because for about 30 or 40 years, we've been arguing that place matters and that, you know, growing up in a concentrated poverty neighborhood affects your mobility. And we had indirect evidence of this, you know, all sorts of regression studies and all sorts of, for that matter, ethnographies. And by the way, anybody in this country knows you grow up in a, excuse my French, shitty neighborhood, it's going to affect your ability to get ahead, right? Everybody knows this. But Chetty came along and he had, you know, IRS returns for how many is it, 20 million people, and he was able to follow them, you know, across time. And he proved definitively, right, that place matters, right? That so I'm all in favor of his research. And if you look at his policy suggestions, they're not all, you know, mobility solutions, right? That he talks about, you know, connecting people with middle class folks, you know, in the communities where they live. He talks about, you know, community development. I mean, the question is how to do this most effectively. And we argue, it, once again, it's not an either or, we got to do both. And of course, it will depend upon the circumstance, right? Maybe in some communities in St. Louis, the market is so weak that you can't develop the communities into healthy mixed income neighborhoods with opportunity, right? But there are other neighborhoods where you can, right? And so maybe we should help some people move to a suburban community with a mix of incomes and better schools and lower crime. But maybe we should take these middle neighborhoods, these ones that are threatened, right, invest in them so that they can be solidified, so they can be healthy places for people to live and fix up the homes, by the way.
Todd, I really want to thank you for joining us today on Unfrozen. This has been Todd Swenstrom talking about his book, The Other Housing Crisis, Ending the Deterioration and Loss of Affordable Homes. Thank you so much for joining us on Unfrozen today. Lots to think about. Clearly, there was no one right answer, but it's important that we've exposed another dimension of the great affordability crisis that we have in this country and indeed around the world.
Good. It was nice to talk to you. I enjoyed the conversation.